Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
Make no mistake about it, we are feeling the impact of a changing climate. Think back to this summer, the drought, the sweltering record temperatures here in the Midwest, that hazardous smoke we had to breathe coming from the massive wildfires out west in Canada, the torrential rainfalls elsewhere in the U.S. and around the world. What can we expect in the future for our climate? What actions can we take now to moderate the catastrophic scenarios we face if we do nothing? Today, my guests are scientists who put together the recently released Assessment of Iowa's Climate, lead authors of the Iowa Climate Statement. More than 200 scientists from Iowa colleges and universities have signed the 2023 Iowa Climate Statement. And a key message for this hour, how harnessing solar energy not only mitigates climate change, but also boosts our state's economy. We'll also explore the rise of something called agrivoltaics, using land for energy production and agriculture at the same time. How's that possible? We'll find out. Joining us for the entire hour, and first of all, David Courard-Howry is Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability at Drake University. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
Gene Tonkley is with us as well, Distinguished Emeritus Professor of Agronomy at Iowa State University. Gene, good to have you back.
Thanks for inviting me, Ben.
David, as the leader here, the leader of this group this year, and for those who don't know, tell us more in general about the Iowa Climate Statement. How and why did it get started?
So back in 2011, a group of us got together and felt like it would make sense to communicate to Iowans sort of what's going on in Iowa in particular as far as climate change is concerned and how what we do in Iowa affects things. I think that often the climate discussion feels very distant to a lot of people, even though, as you mentioned at the in the intro, you know, we're definitely feeling the effects. So we wanted to help with that, and so we started releasing every year a climate statement. And essentially, what happens there is we have a group of experts in Iowa, you know, a number of the members of the IPCC and so on are on those committees. And we look at sort of like what's going on, what can be done to address it. And we each year kind of focus on a slightly different topic. So anyway, so then once we've come up with an idea, we work with both our core group and then all the signatories to work out a statement that everybody feels is well supported and you know, strongly justifiable. So, and then we circulate it, and as you mentioned, we had, you know, over 200 science faculty in climate and climate impacted fields from, and I should mention, from, you know, 36 colleges, which is almost all the colleges and universities here in Iowa. Join on.
In just a moment, I want to have Gene talk a little bit more in depth about how climate change is impacting Iowa and the Midwest specifically. But David, continue there with this year's climate assessment. What is the thrust of this year's messages?
Yeah, so this year's climate statement, each of the statements, we essentially begin with identifying some of the issues that we've noticed in the past year. So we start with that. But the focus here is on solar energy and the idea that in Iowa, we're really kind of underutilizing solar. As you know, we have a really large base of wind power, but wind and solar can be complementary in a lot of ways, and we use a lot less solar than, for example, you know, Minnesota, that's north of us, right? So it gets less solar, you know, incoming solar energy. So anyway, we wanted to identify that there were a lot of opportunities with solar, that solar energy is today is very different from just the solar market. 10 years ago, the market has entirely changed. And so we want people to, notice that and think about, the benefits that can come from complementing wind with solar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and we'll talk about that more in depth in just a moment. Gene Tockley, how is climate change impacting Iowa specifically? We talk to you from time to time, and I just listed at the start there the ways in which the Midwest, the country, the world is experiencing extreme weather. We think very much having to do with climate change. Give us your current assessment.
Sure. Well, of course, climate change is local when it comes to living with it and recovering from it. So climate change has been very costly to the state of Iowa over the last 40 years or so that NOAA has been keeping track of this. They keep track of what they call billion-dollar climate disasters. And over the last 42 years, Iowa has had 64 of these billion-dollar climate disasters, individual climate disasters. And with most of these, 50 of them, coming in the last 20 years. And these are principally due to flooding, drought, and extreme storms, such as the 2020 derecho. So it comes in a variety of forms. They're getting to be more, as most of us have been around for a while, have noticed that flooding is becoming more of an issue, and heavy rainfall, particularly in the April, May, June period. And this has caused headaches for getting the crops in the ground and so on. But on the other hand, this year was a different kind of situation, and it's been more drought. So there's been more, it's underscored the fact that there are more extremes in both directions in some of these climate events that we've been experiencing. But at any rate, the billion-dollar disasters keep on coming, many times a new and surprising manifestation each year.
Mm-hmm. How do we know these billion-dollar disasters are tied with humans' action that has produced a great deal of greenhouse gas and is changing our climate?
That's a good question, and it's always easy to just jump on the bandwagon and claim climate change is responsible for all this, but it's actually a very specific science of attribution. That is, what can we attribute this particular event to? And for instance, the derecho, this was a really abnormality, but on the other hand, we get other kinds of abnormalities too. So there are people who look into this, scientific groups that look into it, and what's the probability that this could have happened under the 20th century climate, and we're finding that there are more and more of these events that happen that are really outliers. There was the extra energy or the extra water vapor transported or something about it that made it stand out from the climate of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. And Gene, unless we take action, what is the course? I mean, we already have made some progress here, right?
Yes, and I was in a position to play a role both in hardening our landscapes and our society and so on to increased weather extremes, but also we have a chance to mitigate, that is to suppress future climate change, because we're very rich in resources, as we've shown with the rise in wind energy and the fact that historically we've had agricultural products that can, in the case of biofuels and so on, have been able to provide us with some transition type of solutions for reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. And so this year's statement then focused on solar energy as what the possibilities are there. So I think it was a timely topic for our group to look at that, so that we could look at what role Iowa can play in the mitigation of future climate change.
Mm-hmm. David and Gene, we'll hear from Peter Thorne in just a moment. He couldn't join us live. A recorded conversation coming up with him that I had yesterday, really focusing on the many aspects of solar. I'll ask you to join in after that as well to emphasize any of the points that he's making or make additional ones. But we have about a minute before we go to break, David. How much of Iowa's solar energy resources are untapped? Can you put a dollar figure on that, for instance?
That's a great question. I can't put a dollar figure on it off the top of my head. Essentially, if you look at the amount, like the amount of land that it would take to essentially run all of Iowa's electricity or produce all of Iowa's electricity from solar, you know, that could fit into part of a county, right? So the total potential resources of Iowa as far as solar is concerned are extremely large. Obviously we're not going to tap all of that, but we could make a huge amount of progress on a very small amount of land.
Okay, stay put, please, David and Gene. David Courard-Howry, Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability at Drake University, joining us this hour, as well as Gene Talkley of Iowa State University, Distinguished Emeritus Professor of Agronomy.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including above and beyond cancer.
Well, we are all experiencing the effects of a changing climate. We just have to think back to this summer's record high temperatures and that very bad air, the dangerous air quality from the wildfires this past summer. This hour, we're talking about the latest annual climate statement for Iowa. It's the 13th. More than 200 scientists from Iowa colleges and universities have signed the 2023 Iowa Climate Statement. So today on the program, we're talking with several scientists involved with putting together this latest assessment. And you can join us with your questions about the changing climate in Iowa, the Midwest, and the challenges of mitigating the worst consequences of these greenhouse gases. Peter Thorne is a University of Iowa Distinguished Chair and Professor in the University of Iowa College of Public Health, also co-director of the Environmental Health Sciences Research Center. He couldn't join us live for today's program. However, I had a chance to talk with him yesterday in our studio. Peter Thorne, welcome.
Hello, Ben.
Well, let's start off with why this year's statement is focused on Iowa's potential to tap solar energy resources.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we really are doing very well in the state of Iowa with about 58% of our electricity coming from wind, but that's pretty much tapping out, and we're missing a huge opportunity to couple that with solar energy, which has come down in price tenfold since 2009 or 2010. And it really is the cheapest source of new installed electricity generation there is. They couple very well together. So putting solar and wind and battery storage together is really the key to the future sustainable energy system.
When you say it's untapped, what does that mean? To what degree can we still tap more solar energy? And what would that look like on our landscape?
Yes. Iowa for wind is about number one in the country in terms of the proportion of our energy we generate, whereas we're only about 1% energy coming from solar. We could greatly increase that. We have the land area to do so, and the, as I said, the price is so low that that's the best way to do it. And it really doesn't take much land mass to produce a lot of solar energy. So building new utility-scale solar, while at the same time we start to put solar on buildings and covering parking lots, that's a win-win for everyone. The economics are good, the timing is right, and the price is low.
Mm-hmm. Talk more about the economics from different perspectives. You said the cost of this is lowered, but it could also be an economic boost for Iowa. What do you mean?
Right. So when we build a solar farm, that employs people to do the land preparation, to install the solar panels and the the stands on which they sit, electricians to come in. And so if those are all local jobs, that produces a boon to the economy. The other thing it does is it really provides electricity that's reliable and less expensive than even already existing and fully depreciated coal or oil and gas installations. And now with the Infrastructure Act and the Inflation Reduction Act that have come through, there's a lot of financial incentives to build more solar and renewables, and this takes the price to almost zero.
Mm-hmm. Given the current technology and the cost of the current technology, when you make that investment, how long does it take to recoup the costs and then be really in the black?
Yeah, so there's different ways to do the pricing on it. Let's separate homeowners from utility scale. With utility scale, they can have a production incentive credit, or they can take a single investment credit up front. Either way is favorable, but that production credit, they can be recouping, it's about 2.6 cents per megawatt hour over time. And so it really makes it very affordable. In terms of homeowners or commercial installations, 30% to 50% of the cost of that can be returned from the incentives provided through those two pieces of legislation that were passed in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest obstacles you see to pursuing this path vigorously and that vast amount of untapped solar energy resource?
Yeah, I think that there are some community concerns that have to be addressed. We want to make sure that when these permitting and siting decisions are made at the local level, that there's input from the community. There have been a few times when these projects went forward and they used labor that was brought from out of state, and perhaps the wages were not favorable. So we're seeing that with community engagement, the new projects that are being approved are using local labor that are being mm-hmm. paid fair wages and jobs benefits. And that benefits the community as a whole and the people who are going to be supporting those installations will see the benefit to their community as a whole. So I think that's really a key part of it, that the community is engaged.
Let's talk about this term that not a lot of us are acquainted with, agrivoltaics, land used not only for energy production, not only for agriculture, but being used for both of those at the same time. How does that work? Because to me, I see a field of solar panels, and then how do you grow things in that field at the same time?
Yeah. So we're used to this with wind. We see a wind turbine in the middle of a cornfield or a soybean field, and that's a common thing to see in Iowa. And some solar installations have been put down where they basically put gravel and covered up the soil to put those solar panels, and that's not the way we want to do it. What we want to do is take land that may not be the best for agricultural production and build prairies there or build pasture land underneath the solar panels. And indeed, many plants do better when they are protected from that midday peak sun and heat.
We have some research going on at ISU. I believe this has been financed by the U.S. Department of Energy, a big 10-acre agrivoltaics, a research solar farm there, too. The reason I raise that is how much of this technology needs to be innovated? How much of it exists right now for agrivoltaics?
Well, the technology exists. It's pretty well recognized that this is a good way to go. I think what the current research is trying to establish is like how much can you improve the soil? You can take marginal soil and you can actually improve it and sequester more carbon in the soil through proper management. So this kind of a demonstration project can show us that this can help the environment and mitigate greenhouse gases in many different ways, not just generating the electricity, but also sequestering carbon in the soil. So it's a form of carbon farming.
Some listening might be saying, well, hey, we've got our renewable resource in our landscape, corn producing ethanol here. This would just displace corn producing ethanol. What are the considerations there?
Well, first of all, the amount of land it requires is minuscule compared to corn-based ethanol. I mean, when you look around the state, you see all that corn that's being used for ethanol production. It's about 100 acres of corn-based ethanol will generate the same amount of energy as 1 acre that's in photovoltaic solar. So it's much more favorable in terms of land use on the solar side. The other thing is that when you generate produce ethanol from corn starch, corn kernels, that requires a lot of inputs of fossil fuels, the fuel to run the farm machinery over that, the pesticides, the fertilizer.
The water.
But the things I mentioned all come from petroleum products.
I see.
Yeah, so that's where I was going with that. And so you know, that has its inefficiencies. And, you know, to a large extent, we can do a really great job with solar. And as I say, when it's paired with wind and battery storage, it's really a really good way to generate electricity for the state.
Well, thanks for coming in today, Peter Thorne, environmental health scientist at the University of Iowa. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Always happy to be with you.
That conversation recorded yesterday with Peter Thorne, back live now to discussing this year's Iowa Climate Statement. Peter, one of the leaders of a group of scientists that put together this year's statement, joining us live now, David Coorard Howry, professor of environmental science and sustainability at Drake, Gene Talkley of Iowa State University. Let me just start. We have some emails. Listeners want to get into our conversation. Before we go to that, David, let me have you react to what Peter said. Perhaps there are aspects of the solar discussion that you'd like to emphasize or add to what Peter said.
Yeah, there are a couple. One is, you know, Peter mentioned the health benefits. There are, if you look at studies of, you know, health impacts of fossil fuel production, it looks like around 100,000 premature deaths happen in the United States every year due to pollution from fossil fuel use, and that's by far the most significant environmental, anthropogenic environmental killer, essentially, is air pollution. And it's something that we've just grown to live with, although maybe not at the levels that we've seen with the fires this year. But that's in some sense, at this point, voluntary, because we can, as he mentioned, transition away from coal in particular, but all the polluting technology. So I think that's a aspect that people may not think much about, is what are the health costs, mm-hmm. Regardless of climate change, of our current system of producing energy.
Gene, I want to have you go in a little bit more depth to what Peter mentioned and you mentioned earlier, how solar and wind energy, both renewable energies, how does that work? We know the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine. How do potentially solar and wind systems work together with batteries, right?
Yes, and Iowa is a good place to demonstrate that, and we already are, of course, because our sun shines during the day, but maybe people aren't aware of this, but the wind is actually maximum at night, and so in many seasons. And so it's what we call, they're complementary, that we use one and switch to another during the diurnal cycle. Also during the seasonal cycle, of course, solar's maximum in the summer, and our wind is generally a little bit lower in the summer on average, higher in the spring and winter when solar is low. So this complementarity is something that we can demonstrate, and it gives us an advantage over other high wind states over other high solar states, that we have this complementarity. We don't have to bring in natural gas plants or whatever to compensate nearly as much as other states might have to do.
Let's go to our first caller today, Denise in Cass County. Welcome, Denise. What perks up your ears about this conversation today?
Oh, what perks my ears is, I'm wondering, there's a big resistance in my part of the state in Southwest Iowa on zoning boards, and people are kicking in resisting pipelines and wind. And many of them feel like the solar farms are taking up too much land as well. And so I'm wondering if anyone is working with the zoning boards, educating them on the benefits of all this. And my husband and I have solar on our farm. We put it in 2 years ago. So I think we're going to our third year, and are really pleased with the results of what we have, and are very much advocates for solar. We grow too much corn in Iowa, so taking land out of production to me wouldn't be a big thing, and putting prairie in would be really great.
Denise, thank you for contributing with your solar system, you and your husband there in Cass County. We have just over a minute before we go to break. David, you deal with policy here as well as the environment in your work. What do you have to say to Denise's concerns there?
Yeah, I think that you definitely see some pushback in some places. Some of it is fear of, more industrial-looking landscape that some people feel when they pass large solar fields, and also some of it is just a result of our increasingly polarized politics. And so, there's a mix of those kind of things. I think that if the wind might have met a much more difficult political climate if it had risen today than it did. And we would have lost out a lot if that had happened, 10 years ago. So I think there's a lot of things going on. I'm thrilled to hear that she's excited about the solar on her farm, because I think word of mouth is probably the best way to address concerns like that. But one of the things, and I know we're running low on time, one of the things that does challenge solar is a diversity of local regulations, and so every solar installation has to be kind of a bespoke installation, driving soft costs up rather than sort of the cost of just the utilities or the installation. Soft costs are about half.
We have to take a break. David, I'll have to cut you off there. David and Gina will be back. It's River to River from IPR News.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
Talking about the 2023 Iowa Climate Statement this hour with several leading scientists who put it together this hour. Gene Tockley of Iowa State University, David Courard Howry of Drake University. And in just a moment, we'll talk with Ulrika Passa of ISU about buildings and sustainability. Let's address some of the what may be termed gripes about solar. Roger writing us, he says, I hear little conversation about how much it takes to dig the elements from the earth to build solar panels or wind generators. You don't hear much about the energy needed to haul those raw materials to factories, how much it costs to transport the parts, the pieces to the resting places, how much it costs to install, how much maintenance is. So Roger, it sounds like he's full of doubts. David, help him out there.
Yeah, well, the way that you analyze that is with what's called a life cycle assessment, where you look at the total impact of your system, not just as it's running, but, as you're doing all the things that he mentions. And without getting into details of life cycle assessments, alternative energies, electric cars, those people often have some of those concerns about those, especially when you see pictures of, disposal of wind turbines and stuff, because they're large on an individual scale. But at the same time, if you think about things like the immense amount of toxic coal ash that gets produced when we burn coal, and the amount of mining that goes in there, it turns out that on a life cycle basis, that renewables do win, certainly over fossil fuels, essentially across the board.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Catherine in Northeast Iowa. Catherine, I think you had a related question. Go ahead. Welcome.
I have a couple of comments and a question. Well, I am a zoning administrator for a county up here. What I understand from people in my county, what they're afraid of is the 400-acre solar farm. That's what they don't want to see affecting their landscape. And then I've had several questions about, well, what's the disposal end of this? What happened, because they don't want it to end up like the wind turbines. Secondly is, we also farm on the side. We have a dairy farm, and we did put in solar, and it brought our bill down from probably $3,000 a month to $1,200 to $1,500. So that has been, for our pocketbook, a fabulous benefit. But like I said, from a zoning perspective, I think what I see is they don't want to see the big ones, and what's the disposal end of that? Because we're all in a hurry to do these pipelines, wind turbines, and we have wind turbines. But what's the disposal end of that? Those are the complaints that I hear from, or the concerns, I guess, that I hear from people.
Catherine, thank you for raising those concerns. David or Gene, David, you want to tackle that? The mega solar farms that seem to be a concern to some.
Yeah, obviously, you know, one of the things we mentioned in the statement is that, you know, you need to have these conversations locally, because what may work some in one place may not work in another. Again, as I was mentioning, you know, the more we can standardize rules, the easier it is to build these things. But local communities have to figure out what works there. And if, you know, large scale solar doesn't make sense in a community, then that may be the way it goes. Obviously, there are significant economies of scale to building solar. So the larger that you can do in a way that works with the community, often the less expensive that's going to be. But that all depends on mm-hmm. specifics. As far as disposal, absolutely, you know, there's disposal, but at the same time, remember that you're talking about a 20-year installation, and if you think about the actual mass in an individual solar array, and you compare that against again, you know, a plant that's producing electricity via fossil fuels or all the other things that we dispose of similar scales. Renewable energy, the disposal costs there, because they're highly efficient, really are relatively low.
Final 10 minutes talking about this year's Iowa climate statement with its focus on solar energy, how solar energy would not only be good for mitigating the effects of climate change, but also really good business to place more emphasis on that. That's the message out of this year's group of scientists. Over 200 signed onto it this hour, talking to four of the scientists who in this group leading, organizing the creation of this climate Iowa climate statement. We haven't talked yet with Ulrika Passa. Ulrika is a professor of architecture, director of the Center for Building Energy Research at Iowa State University. Ulrika, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
You're bringing a wrinkle into our conversation we haven't had yet, buildings and sustainability. What are your main concerns and messages here?
Well, the concerns I have that we have the technologies and we have the knowledge to build and to retrofit buildings for solar adoption, and that we might not do it fast enough. That is a concern. I think my hope is that we will bring the building energy efficiency, you know, forward in the next couple of years, and that people will adopt more solar, as those colleagues and residents of Iowa who were on the telephones earlier already have done. And I think these experiences will help bring solar into our communities more than right now, because I know there are folks who already have solar on their homes and they are happy with the outcome and the reduction of their utility bills. So I'm quite hopeful in the next years. We've built a house with students 12 years ago, which was still is powered by solar arrays. So
this is the Honey Creek Resort House, correct?
Yes, we called it the Interlock House. It was built for a U.S. Department of Energy competition. Solar student teams from all across the country built homes which were powered by the sun. We were all on the mall in Washington at the time in 2009, and brought, you know, showcased the potential for design, for architectural design, to design buildings which are fully powered by the sun across the year.
Yeah, what are the takeaways from building that home, that project, as an idea of what we may be facing in the future in terms of changes in designs in our home, so that we can better take advantage of the sun's power? What are some big ticket items there that we should keep in mind?
Well, one is, as already was mentioned, orientation. And I think, you know, given that we are living in a cardinal grid, that is not so difficult, because we have our lots are usually have one side which is oriented to the south, and that is the most advantageous orientation for solar. It is thinking a little bit more about how we plant trees with solar on our properties, large or small. And it's, you know, because trees are useful to reduce air temperature, but PV arrays also provide electricity. So, you know, the placement is important and the design can be important, but it doesn't have to look change the look of the building, because, you know, we need a little bit more passive strategies and efficient wall and window assemblies. And then you can go solar, as the some previous listener said.
Yeah. Ulrika, Mike in Waterloo has a question, I think, that's something in your field of expertise. Mike asks, how can I determine whether solar is economically feasible, besides environmentally, whether it's viable for my 1,100-square-foot residence?
1,100-square-foot residence. Oh, yeah. So you would take, and actually I have I had a graduate student who, in her master's thesis, designed a GIS-based tool, map-based tool, to give homeowners the opportunity to assess their own location. It's not yet publicly available, but there are similar tools. You can, you know, you measure the energy per square foot of your, you can assess the per square foot energy falling on your roof, and that can be converted with a very simple calculation into the kilowatt hours you can bring into your building.
Mm-hmm. We're winding up our conversation. These lithium batteries, perhaps we can go back to you, Gene, for that. Talk about the battery technology, since you are into the systems here. What's the state of that technology? And we always hear about lithium, critical for making these high-performance batteries. Do we have enough of that in the U.S.? Is that found everywhere on the planet?
excuse me. No, it isn't. But And I'm not an expert in specifically where this is mined, but I know there have been some real advances in battery technology and ability to store larger amounts. And there are other factors to consider, that, for instance, long-term storage versus very short-term storage. And so there may be other opportunities to just be able to store large amounts of energy for a few hours to get through the diurnal cycle, the day-night cycle, rather than store it in the summer and use it in the winter. So I think we just have to be smarter about our use of energy, and at the same time that we are improving our battery technology, we should be looking at ways that we can use the renewable energy to be complementary and to be plug the gaps where we have excess and can develop other renewables to fill in the gaps.
Mm-hmm. David, in our final couple of minutes, you are, of course, expertise in environmental science and sustainability, but also policy here. Address some of the misinformation. We've heard some pushback this hour. Is there misinformation out there that farmers, that others here in Iowa need to really check out, that you've encountered?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, as we've talked about, one of the things is, you know, the efficiency on a per acre basis. And I think people don't understand quite how efficient solar really is when you compare it against other things that we're growing for electricity, or for energy, I should say. So that's one. And then the other is the fear that, you know, we're running low on, as you were mentioning, lithium. And there's no question that, you know, we face limited resources in terms of that. But I feel like one of the main kind of lessons of the environmental movement in the 80s or 1980s was sort of that the economy is actually really good at replacing, finding ways to replace things that you may be running low on. So people were really worried about running out of resources, and that didn't turn out to be the environmental challenge. The environmental challenge was, this stuff all building up in the atmosphere, for example, and I mean other environmental challenges as well. So I guess my point is, I think that I would encourage people to focus on what we have and what we can do now, and imagine that I think we probably will be able to solve those problems as they come up, as we sort of always have.
Mm-hmm. David, in the final 30 seconds, give us some places to go for those who want to answer questions they may have or find out more about how solar energy may become a part of their lives. Quickly, please.
Yeah, I think your local solar installer is probably the best person. They can, look up, solar energy and you can find a lot of information just by talking with those individuals.
Okay. David Gourard Howry, Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability at Drake University. Gene Tockley, Distinguished Emeritus Professor of Agronomy at ISU. Ulrika Passa, Professor of Architecture and Director of the Center for Building Energy Research at ISU. Ulrika, Gene, and David, thank you very much for taking part today and delivering these very important messages.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Today's program produced by Samantha McIntosh with help from Caitlin Troutman. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.